Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The path to reconciliation is one of listening, learning, and growing together. A path that recognises the central place of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our past and in our future. It is in that spirit that we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay tribute to elders past, present, and future.
Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy issues facing Australia and the world. Policy Forum Pod is produced by the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. I'm Anna-Greta Hunter, and I'm delighted to be here again with my co-host, Sharon Bessel. Sharon, how are you?
Hi, Anna-Greta. I'm great. Good to be here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation today.
So am I.
We recently spoke with Rob Hopkins about imagining the future. And today we're focusing a little less on imagining the future and more on modelling the future. Although in modelling where we will be as a country in 40 years, we also have the opportunity to imagine where we want to be and who we want to be as a nation. Recently, the Treasurer, Dr. Jim Chalmers, handed down the Intergenerational Report, which overviews the forces that will shape our nation over the next 40 years. In his foreword to the report, the Treasurer refers to the work that's needed to create prosperity, to expand opportunity, and to build a stronger, more sustainable, and more inclusive nation. Today, we'll dive into the Intergenerational Report, particularly focusing on issues of sustainability and transition, and equality and inequality. And to talk us through these issues, we have two wonderful colleagues from here at the ANU joining us. Professor Paul Burke is head of the Arndt Cordon Department of Economics and Deputy Director of the Crawford School of Public Policy here at the ANU. He's also a researcher in the Zero Carbon Energy for Asia Pacific Research Initiative, which is also here at ANU. Paul, welcome. It's fantastic to have you with us.
Great to be here.
And we also have Dr. Liz Allen joining us. Liz is a demographer at the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods and has deep experience across both public and university sectors. In 2018, she was appointed as an inaugural ABC Top 5 Humanities and Social Sciences researcher, and she's the author of the truly wonderful book, The Future of Us. Liz, welcome.
Oh, it's fantastic to be among such esteemed company.
It's great to have you here, Liz.
It is great. I'm so looking forward to speaking with the two of you today about this important report. As we spoke to Rob Hopkins just recently about the importance of imagination and seeing what the future might hold, this report does give us some really important insights into that. But let's start with some conversation. Paul, the Intergenerational Report was released on the 24th of August and it maps out and predicts what Australia might look like over the next 40 years. I wonder if you could talk us through what role the Intergenerational Report plays in policy makings and how those predictions about our future are made.
Well, this is a report that's released every few years. The key focus really is about the budget. The key part of this particular report is looking at what might the budget balance be if policy settings are in line with certain assumptions as we go 40 years down the road. So the report presents projections. They're not forecasts, and the assumptions in there are really very important. This report, really the main takeaway is that life is projected to be quite a lot better into the future. More productive, higher incomes, a smaller gender gap in terms of labour force participation. It comes down really to the assumptions there. So Treasury, in this report, they have assumed that productivity growth will be, that's output per person, per worker, will be settling at about the 20-year average of 1.2% per year. So if you make that assumption and then roll forward to 20, 63. That means when we're at that point, our per person output will be much higher, incomes much higher as well. The key thing here, really, it doesn't look across every topic in Australia. It's focused on, in particular, the budget. And this particular report also has a climate and energy chapter, which is good to see.
Paul, thanks. What we're hoping to do over this conversation is unpack some of those assumptions a little bit more and think about, you know, the extent to which that report is putting us on a track towards the kind of the sustainable and the equitable society that's referred to, particularly in the foreword of the report. But Liz, before we go deeper into some of the challenges and the opportunities, can you just outline for us what the intergenerational report predicts our population will look like by 2063, how it will change over the next 40 years, and what you're seeing in your work about those population changes that we can expect?
Yeah, look, the intergenerational report of the IGR is demographer gold. I still remember the 2002 IGR. I was still an undergrad student. And it was like this kind of treasure chest or holy grail of, oh, my goodness, they're finally listening to us and demography has gone mainstream. So I still kind of every time I think of the IGR, it transports me back to this kind of giddy young upstart who really didn't know what they were doing but kind of fumbled their way through becoming a demographer by accident. So it kind of the IGR holds a really emotional, I think, place in my heart associated with quite a lot of things. The IGR gets a really bad rap. In its earliest days, it was that kind of, okay, we know we're aging, we know we've got these demographic difficulties ahead of us. How do we really take control of our destiny so that we don't kind of assume that demography is our destiny and it can happen unto us without our kind of say about the system and the outcome, really? So what does this IGR say? I think there are a number of things that we need to think about in the context of this IGR. It has come sooner than scheduled, really. It's meant to be every 5 years, although it's been longer in some cases. This is the first time we've seen the IGR come sooner rather than later. And it is also the first to truly capture the full breadth of COVID lockdowns and border closures. The last one did give us some indication, but it didn't tell a full story of the kind of stop, start, and then what happens next type thing after border reopening. So that's important. It's the second under a Labor government, and it is, I guess, we've seen IGRs probably from the second one onwards become really very political and used as more of a political manifesto than I guess an evidence-based approach to what's going on. So what does this one say? This one says that Australia will be older, bigger, slower growing, more diverse, with living standards at risk of going backwards. I mean, these are the key takeaways from a demographic perspective. And I think that kind of hidden among that is the reality that we're headed into the greatest demographic headwinds of our time. And I know that many will say, oh my gosh, Liz, you do have a way with exaggerating, but that's the bottom line. The IGR is essentially about laying out the challenges to the budget bottom line. What are the factors that are going to impede our future? And how do we overcome these demographic hurdles? And so the two words that are kind of most commonly uttered when talking about the IGR are challenges and opportunities, right? And we heard the Treasurer say these things. We've got challenges, we know that. Yeah, hello. And these challenges, by the way, are not a fast-moving bullet train. They are a slow-moving red rattler, right? Very slow moving train that we've seen these on the horizon since the 90s with regard to an aging population. The fact that we've not really done anything earnest by way of policy and so on is really frustrating, because while we weren't looking, inequality has, in my mind, and I'm sure Paul will have opinions on this, has become more stubborn and deeper and wider in its breadth in Australia, because we've got inter and intra-generational inequalities now presenting really stubborn and complex challenges. So what do we do with these things? Well, this IGR is like we've been presented a demographic choose-your-own-adventure. We've got all of these opportunities now in front of us. We know what might happen with this route if we take this stream of opportunity and so on. What happens if we do nothing? Hopefully, but I'm not holding my breath, we might see some earnest and substantive change to actually take control and not assume demographic destiny.
Wow, that's a really extraordinary overview, I think, particularly of the history of the intergenerational report. Liz, thank you so much for that. Let's start by unpacking a bit of those demographic headwinds. As you've just gone through, the implications of Australia's ageing population has been a topic of discussion for many years. And Liz, you've just given us some remarkable insights into the important role that plays in policy research. The report highlights that Australians are expected to continue living longer and remaining healthier to an older age whilst having fewer children. This is leading to an ageing and slower growing population. Paul, one of the many issues that arises from that demographic trend is, of course, the implications for the tax and revenue base of the country. And again, perhaps we can frame this through that risk and opportunity lens. If the tax base declines, what options are available for alternative sources of government revenue? Is this a policy opportunity?
Well, that's a great question. In terms of this particular report, that issue is assumed away. Tax is assumed to be 24.4% of GDP in steady state, and that will go out until 2062-63. So this report, it's very inflexible on the tax side of things. It's just assumed like that. And that's actually by design as well. If we don't do anything, then look what might happen. We have a lot of opportunities, of course, to be doing work on the tax side, to be, first of all, boosting the efficiency via which we collect tax revenue, and also collecting more revenue. We have a lot of needs here. And that's really what the report does a much better job on, and that is identifying growth items on the expenditure side. So in particular, it identifies a number of areas where there's expected to be quite a bit of growth in expenditure. Those are health, aged care, the NDIS, defence, and also interest payments on government debt. So those items are growing. And basically what the report does is show that as a result of that, we would slip into a budget deficit and stay in one. Therefore, what's the conclusion? And it's quite an obvious next step type of conclusion. Well, let's adjust over time. We have opportunities to do that, both on the tax and the expenditure sides. On the tax side, well, we do have a big chance here. And one thing the report does is it mentions the potential for growth in exports of various commodities, minerals. As part of the energy transition, there'll be lots of global demand for lithium and so on. So part of the story is making sure that we're collecting enough revenue from profits that are made in those extraction activities. But there's much more to the story as well. Tax is a big issue, and that's really our bottom line of this report. Let's make sure that we do take a step to get out of that long-run structural deficit, which we would do over time, but it's laying it out. It will be there if we don't do anything.
Liz, you noted earlier that standards of living are under threat and pointed out the stubbornness of inequality. And you've written very powerfully about the way in which inequality impacts on families and young people in particular, and on those people who are living in poverty. Does the IGR help us to move beyond that kind of demographic destiny that you identified so powerfully earlier? And does it help us to think more creatively and more equitably about the kinds of policy options that we might want to pursue?
Yeah, the IGR, I think, is the way to think about it is like a reference book or a reference Bible that we kind of go to. This is the evidence. And then from that, we then think about, okay, what bits do we pull out from that and then kind of apply it in a way that makes sense? And so the IGR can't be everything, nor should it be everything. But I think you're right. This IGR, much like I think certainly the first IGR as well under Costello as treasurer, that we now have this evidence base that shows, yes, we've got problems. And going back to what Paul has said, that we, you know, that this kind of, we have a challenge by way of how we're going to fund this place. How are we going to keep the lights on, so to speak, the countrywide, right? How are we going to fund what are essentially competing demands? We've got this aging population, which, by the way, is not necessarily a bad thing. But when we have these challenges of competing demands, particularly across the age life course, for what could be a relatively shrinking pot of money, which by and large comes from individual taxpayers, and we know that this relative pool of individual taxpayers is under threat because of aging, we then kind of think, okay, are we going to have to do more with less? If we're not going to change the way that we do tax in this country, and basically that's what we're hearing from politicians, is we're not going to change anything. There's no reform in sight. So what does that mean? We're going to have to get smarter with what we're doing, right? And that often gets forced on the individual. The trouble is, and I think the IGR does spell this out quite nicely, though not terribly explicitly, is that we are not good in this country at imagining the whole of something. We're very good at looking at segments. We're very good at looking at policy silos. If it fits in this box, we're okay to look at it over here. We are never very good at, or good at all, kind of looking at all of the puzzle pieces together. Our population story, which fits within this kind of cradle to the grave approach, even before an individual is conceived, right the way through their life course. So we've got things like education, we've got things like healthcare, employment, workplace factors, housing, climate change, work security, living standards. All of these things are essentially about human well-being, but they tend to sit across disparate policy pieces. They rarely get joined up. They rarely have politicians who are in the same party talk to each other about the consequences of what they're doing in a whole of government or holistic kind of way. What that then means is we've got these competing challenges, we've got these kind of, instead of puzzle pieces fitting together, we have these tectonic plates smashing against each other, causing kind of seismic issues that have ripples amongst generations, within generations, but also beyond that and then down the line of generations. So let me take a step back and reconsider your question. There are opportunities that, oh word, alongside the challenges that we can take from this. The trouble is we require reform, because in theory, in an aging population, we would see transfers occur between generations. So we would see empty nesters vacate their big family homes, for younger generations to then take hold of the family homes and so on, either directly through their kind of passed down through families, or the transfers of money, or the sale of these big empty nesting homes to make this housing stock available. That's in theory. That is not what's occurred, and it's not what's likely to occur in the kind of little while. We've got an enormous wealth accumulation among some parts of the population, and we're seeing at the same time issues around growing renting among particularly younger people. But we've seen this post-World War II, generation on generation, more and more people are renting and not buying. Now, in incremental change, that's small. But we're getting to the point of, you know, we're now hearing the word crisis kind of being thrown about quite a lot. In addition to that, we're focused on an aging population over here as the demographic crisis. But in my mind, we're not thinking about the new lot coming in, and we haven't for a mighty long time. Because a true kind of well-being idea of a population is one that sets in train equality right the way through the life course, so that we don't see this kind of segmented ladder of life that sees some people right from the day of conception automatically get greater opportunities. And then what happens is that distance across the life course gets greater as this kind of cumulative impact of disadvantage or advantage takes hold. So we need to get back to reconceptualizing early education, primary school education, post-school training and education, not just higher education, so that we have a workforce of the future that is fit for purpose, and that means that people who want to engage can engage and can do so effectively. That's how we have technically, theoretically, good population well-being. But we're really not seeing, in my mind, the necessary ingredients to put that in train.
Liz, that's such a powerful overview that you've given us. And I love the imagery that you've given us to help us think through some of those challenges that we need to overcome, but also to think about the opportunities. We want to come back after a break to tease out some of those opportunities a little bit more. So listeners, please don't go away. We will be back with Paul Burke and Liz Allen in just a moment.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back. We're here with Paul Burke and Liz Allen, both from the Australian National University, and we're talking about the recent intergenerational report. Paul, I wanted to come back to some of the issues around sustainability and transition. Australia has committed to a net zero economy, and transitioning to that net zero economy requires an energy sector that's built upon renewables and industry that's environmentally sustainable. I wonder if you could begin this part of our conversation by just outlining for us what it's going to take for a fully renewable energy sector. I know that's a very big question, but your thinking around that would be fantastic.
Well, in Australia, the answer, in short, is electricity. And the cheapest way to produce electricity in Australia is using solar and wind. And storage and grid management are also very important for managing those two intermittent types of resource and continuing to use our hydro as well. So, yeah, electricity is at the heart of the solution. First of all, decarbonizing our current electricity system. Second of all, electrify other energy uses. So road transport, industry use of energy, and so on. In the intergenerational report, they do have a look at the future electricity system, and it's looking more and more like a solar and wind dominated grid. There are a lot of challenges in achieving that, but that's the direction we're headed in. And the rest of the world as well is headed in that direction because solar and wind are relatively cheap. And also most new investment in generation capacity for power is in solar or in wind. In this report, they have a climate change and energy chapter, which is great to see. That hasn't always been the case. It's fairly limited, of course, but first thing is great to see it. It's not fully integrated and not looking at all aspects. So just for example, it doesn't mention the Great Barrier Reef even once. It does have a look at the effect of rising temperatures on productivity. But really, the answer there is quite a small effect. It's just about one half of a year of productivity growth that might be lost if we believe the numbers coming out of this type of modeling. So there are questions about the extent to which we could expand what's being done here. And in particular, some examination of the effects of climate change on loss of assets. That's not only the Great Barrier Reef, but also sea level rise affecting beaches and low-lying areas and many other implications as well. In this report, one thing they also do is they have a look at potential scenarios for future thermal coal exports. Australia is a major exporter of thermal coal. Many countries in the region have net zero targets. How is that going to work? They look at a few different scenarios, and all of them involve our thermal coal exports going down. One big notable point, though, I think, is what is not covered here. They don't look at metallurgical coal, and they don't look at liquefied natural gas. Liquefied natural gas is, of course, also a very greenhouse gas intensive export item that we have. And if countries in the region, from Vietnam to China to India to Indonesia, South Korea, Japan, if they have net zero targets, what will that mean for our exports of LNG as well? Australia's in the top three in the world for our LNG exports. And yeah, that particular product got off scot-free in this report. There's just the focus on thermal coal. Of course, one report can't do everything, but it would be good for those very smart people in Treasury to keep going with this work and strengthening it, which I think is probably their plan as well, in terms of integrating that analysis of climate and energy with the productivity assumptions that are at the heart of this report. Currently, there's not really integration there at all. As mentioned, they just assume productivity growth 1.2% per year for the forward years. They could be expanding what they're doing there and really integrating it so that any feedback loops are properly incorporated into the modeling. Just on inequality as well, Liz has been making some great points on inequality. I do think this really is an opportunity for this report. Next time, there should be a chapter on inequality. Wouldn't that be great to see? With some micro simulation modeling, some forward-looking numbers, it really is one of the biggest challenges in Australia. It's wealth inequality. And there are some specific reforms that we could be doing, and just a couple of them, further looking at superannuation tax concessions. That's one approach. The government has taken a step on that. Yeah, they're pretty favourable arrangements that we currently have for tax concessions for people with superannuation balances of, say, $2 million. It's quite a bit of money. Also, at the state level, stamp duty reform as well. I think Liz touched on an important point of using our residential housing stock as efficiently as possible. Australia, we're not doing that at the moment. And stamp duty is one of those contributing factors for that, in that quite a few people are pretty reluctant to move place because of that large stamp duty bill. So yeah, if I were to wish for a couple of things for the next IGR, one, just keep going with the climate and energy and really try to integrate it and strengthen that analysis. And then two, wow, wouldn't an inequality chapter be great?
It would. And if I might just jump in there, I think, Paul, I agree. I think what now needs to happen is we need to see a coherent body of work come out of the IGR. Treasury has proven they've got this expertise. And I think under good stewardship, we could then see Treasury kind of pull out, or whomever it is within government with these skills, pull out these individual threads and really go deep, do a deep dive in these things. And do you know what? I don't think we've really seen an earnest examination of inequality in this country from a government perspective. I can't recall, really. We see little pieces, yes, and we see reports, but I've never ever really kind of seen a reimagination of what inequality looks like from a government perspective. Look, I'm happy to be corrected, but wouldn't that be so lovely? Look, I would be there in the audience for that launch, Paul.
See you there, Liz.
Okay, so we've got two extraordinarily important themes here that have come from the IGR, and they're recognising the extraordinary importance, I think, of this document in provoking really good policy discussion. Paul, can we just come back to the environment briefly? And I just wanted, you sort of touched on the fact that some of the assumptions that then create this model, that then provokes the discussion, are important. So the way in which we take into consideration the input data, the assumptions, and in particular, when we're thinking about the economic impacts of climate change, there's a quite interesting and robust discussion that I have to say I incompletely understand. But what I do understand is that perhaps some of the assumptions assume that most productive work would take place in a temperature stable environment and be relatively protected from the extreme weather events that we know are coming. So I just wondered if you might like to comment on what sorts of assumptions might change for the next IGR. Some of the starting positions worth looking at, and you've given us some lovely examples of how you'd like to see this developed for the next report. Are there other framework shifts that would be useful?
Well, to start off with, this is hard. We're talking about decades into the future. There's a lot of uncertainty. The technologies in 2062 are going to be very different to what we have now. It is hard. Currently, what is done is relatively simple in that the key choice is the productivity growth number, and they have reduced the productivity growth per annum number from what it had been before, so now down to 1.2%, which is based on the average over the last 20 years. It's possible that that is too low, that we might adopt technologies, reform, and grow more quickly. It's also possible that due to climate change, it's too high. There's a lot of uncertainty there. In this report, they could do a bit more on that. So looking at not only the central assumption, but they could do some sensitivity analyses, give some ranges. They could also have a feedback loop. So from the climate modelling, a feedback loop to the productivity growth number. Currently, it's just a growth machine and then climate change is in a different chapter. They could have a feedback loop there, but it is difficult. Fortunately, there are some brilliant people at Treasury who are working on it, and that work is ramping up in terms of general climate work. I do think that's a direction to keep pushing in, is improving this modelling as far as possible, but also recognising that it is difficult. On the environment more broadly, I do think we could be doing more, and that could be another chapter as well, just other environmental implications. If we have 14 million more people by 2063, what's the implication of that? Where would they be? What's the implication for biodiversity, for land use, for forest cover and so on? What's the answer to that? Will they be in cities in highly dense urban environments with little implication for forest cover? Or will it be continued urban growth pushing out? I think it comes back to one of the points Liz said before, in that we often just do a very specific thing, but we're not looking as broadly as we could be in terms of, visioning that future. What would that future in 2062 be? Where are those people? There's certainly no answer in this report. So a chapter on the environment, we do have a separate report called the State of the Environment Report. That's not a forward-looking exercise like this one. So really trying to push those Treasury and other government colleagues, how about bringing those two together in a more integrated way? What would the future scenario be looking like if we were to be following this path? And that would be really useful for policy. If there are parts of that story we don't like, well, let's reform and let's steer in a different direction in terms of, for example, if we're not liking the forest cover implication, the implication for koala biodiversity, well, let's do something about that and encourage more dense urban development rather than continuing to spread out. So, a chapter on the environment and really serious economic environment integrated modelling would be great to see going forward.
Liz, I wanted to pick up on the other main issue that we've been talking about around equality. And of course, that is fundamentally bound up with the issues that Paul's been talking about around the environment and around transition. And you've both pointed out the need to see that additional chapter in the next IGR that's on equality and inequality. And I'll certainly be at that launch with you if that happens. Liz, you said earlier that it would be incredibly valuable for the government to begin to define what it means by inequality. And that kind of definition does bring political risk. And ideally, that conversation needs to be one that's cross-party, that's bipartisan, and that finds ways of working together on these very big issues. But can I ask you to start that conversation for us? How would you like to see inequality defined? And what would you like to see in that new chapter of the next IGR, the chapter on equality and inequality?
Oh, that's a big one.
We like to ask the small questions.
Oh, my goodness. These are hard-hitting questions. And you're right, they are philosophical. They are there's a political aspect to them. I've come as I get older to this realization that you can have the ideal and you can also think of what is doable and what is practical. And I think Australia sometimes avoids doing the kind of the ideal, because we know that it's not practical, or we know that it can't be doable because of political strategy. That's essentially what gets in our way. And I think we need to actually kind of get to that point where we recognize this is the ideal. What does inequality look like? And inequality is not a single measure. Let's be totally clear about that. It is a suite of measures. And it is not just a suite of measures at a one point in time. We need to look at segments of our population. We need to look at age dynamics. We need to consider the composition and what inequality exists within these groups. You know, we hear the word intersectional quite a lot. I don't think we really grasp the concept of intersectionality as it relates to inequality and a disadvantage in this country in an earnest way. So let's actually get that on the table. You know, we've got this wellbeing budget or the women's kind of budget and all these sorts of things. That's a good start to start thinking about the metrics of how we kind of consider how we're doing, right? What we measure matters, because what matters is measured. I know that sounds like a bit of a mind twist, but essentially we've got to be careful that we don't start seeing gaming of these measurements and so on. So really long-winded answer to your question. Let's think about how we philosophically think about inequality, how we imagine these things, and then we consider the pragmatic stuff. Well, what is doable? What is in reach? What is politically survivable? in that just like infrastructure in this country, you know, we have a housing mismatch, we have, you know, a multi-speed economy, depending on who you are, will determine how well you're doing and so on. We need to reconsider now, beyond a political term, what the future looks like. That means that there will need to be decisions made that require a bipartisan approach or a nonpartisan kind of consideration of things. Let's get on the table what inequality looks like for all aspects and known subgroups of our population. By the way, we don't know a lot about our subgroups of our population because we don't even measure it in the census. Things like gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity. We don't know a lot about disability and things like that. We just don't know a lot of these things. So let's consider then, in this wider concept of this conversation, how we define something, how we then might measure it, how we then rate our success against these things, to then consider what is doable. Consider the ideal, consider the doable. And I don't think that is necessarily something that government should be doing, because if we have a lot of this. So say for example, the Population Centre sits within Treasury. They do great work. But what happens if we were to take that population out of Treasury? We have it as an independent body that maybe is government funded or is somehow funded by the ARC, the Australian Research Council, in a way that means that money's divvied up in a way that it's competitive and so on. We then have a body that is not answerable to a government, the government of the day. Maybe that's the way we go and we reconsider these sorts of things. Of course, that's probably not doable, but it's the strategic thing. So I'm not sure I've answered your question, but rather considered the opportunities for how we get to answering this really big question for Australia.
Liz, I was really struck, as I'm sure some of our listeners will be, by that phrase you offered us earlier about how the challenge in imagining the whole of something and the real challenges, particularly from the siloed approach of government, and to some degree in academia, we see the same challenges. Earlier this year, of course, the government released Measuring What Matters framework that presents the indicators of wellbeing. I'd actually love to ask both of you about this, particularly whether that framework is relevant when we're looking at these intergenerational questions. Does it help us in the IGR assessment? And do you think if this framework is useful, then how well does the intergenerational report do in terms of fostering and prioritising wellbeing? Paul, I'd like to start with you. What are your thoughts on the melding of those two approaches?
Well, one could go further. An inequality chapter would be great to see. And how to measure inequality? Liz is right. There are different ways of measuring it. But I think wealth inequality is a key one. The percentage of wealth held by the top 10%, 1%, the Gini coefficient for wealth. Of course, one can have other measures such as Gini coefficient for income as well. And the list goes on. And there's more to it than just only measures of income and wealth to Indigenous performance and so on. We could bring in many other indicators. This report, well, it's tricky because one report can only do so much. But I would say that it would be good to see it to go further in terms of integrating this with broader measures of well-being and also measures such as environmental impact as well. It's something in Australia that we haven't been doing particularly well, in that this report has always been focused on the budget, but the budget is just one aspect of society. Really, what would be great to see is a broad scenarios type report, either by a couple of additional chapters to this one and continuing to bulk it out, or potentially a separate exercise altogether, envisioning what we want society to be and integrating various aspects. It's, again, always going to be somewhat imperfect in terms of this. There are limitations with the data, there are data lags and so on. And that's what could be said about the Measuring What Matters report, is that the data weren't perfect and so on. But yeah, I do think we could be doing much more in terms of having one document that brings together the inequality aspects, the environment aspects, the other economic aspects, income predictions, and so on. This report does a good job, but it's quite limited. It could be broader and just more interdisciplinary. So not just looking at that budget, which economists, of course, love and does capture some headlines, but broadening it out to other dimensions.
Liz, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, what's so interesting about the Measuring What Matters, I think it makes me think about the early discussions around the Millennium Development Goals and the Sustainable Development Goals. And we had the same discussions. Oh, you know, these are kind of pie in the sky. We've not got the right data and so on. You've got to start somewhere. And by signaling the data gaps is actually quite a powerful thing, because it shows where we need to improve. That in itself is a kind of meta indicator. Yes, we don't have this stuff. Oh, that means we might need to collect it, or it's, wow, it's so out of date. Wow, that might mean we need to collect it. We need to start somewhere. And as Paul says, just like life, data are imperfect, right? And nothing is ever going, no one data point is ever going to capture the full breadth of life, right? So I think that's a start. It's a start, and it needs to be improved, these indicators. The trouble with these indicators is that they are disconnected from, or sit far removed from, what I think many people would consider kind of are related. And so there's not this kind of discussion about how we get to that point. It might be in the document, but it's not easily or readily communicated to the general public. So this kind of disconnection from everyday life kind and the discussion that kind of got and sadly got caught up about whether the data was up to date or whatever, it really fails to capture the reality that in the year 2023, for the first time, we have developed indicators to measure our well-being. That's the reality of it, right? You've got to start somewhere. Change is incremental. And I think that these will not be the last. They will grow, these indicators. The trouble is that they are not connected with other policy outcomes, not directly. It's implicit, but not directly. And the next step would then be thinking about the outcomes for each kind of policy domain. How do we actually make change to these kind of set of principles or measurements of well-being and outcomes in accordance with the policy kind of outcomes? How do we actually change these things? It's absolutely meaningless to say that you're going to reduce the number of intimate partner killings of women by, I don't know, let's pick 25%. Because we're happy with the rest of the killings that's happening. It's absolutely meaningless. And the public sees that and goes, okay, that looks good, but so we're happy with everybody else that gets killed? Like, it makes no kind of logical, there's no narrative around progress here and what it means and in order to get people involved and on board. Those sorts of narratives of advancement need to occur. It's just a pity that we don't really have, this kind of, again, we have the political mouthpiece that says these things. We don't really hear from experts. We're not elevating the expert voice in a way that really needs to be done. And the other thing we do really, really poorly, shithouse even, is that we don't hear about experiential knowledge. We don't hear about the lived experience of people. That doesn't enter our kind of narrative. RoboDebt, by the way, has proven, hello, experiential knowledge, lived experience is pretty critical here. And we are still not learning from these things. So, you know, we might see a kind of a number of indicators on a well-being kind of map. But the reality is climate boiling, housing affordability, job insecurity, cost of living, gender equality, all of these things are at front of mind for general people. How do we convey these narratives of importance? And by the way, we know they're important and we're doing work toward them. We're not seeing that those sorts of imaginaries. And I think we need to see that.
Paul and Liz, this has been just an extraordinary conversation. You remind me of some of the many reasons I love working at ANU, the two of you together in the studio, sharing science and imagination and extraordinary insight into this important report. You've given us so much to think about. Thank you so much for joining us. We really look forward to having you back again in the future.
Thanks a lot, Anna Greta.
Thank you. And I really look forward to public release of that inequality chapter. Sign me up, baby.
Absolutely. Can't wait for that, Liz. We'll all be there.
Sharon, this really was one of the most extraordinary conversations we've had, and I'm so glad to have had Liz and Paul join us to bring the depth of their wisdom and understanding, a conversation to provoke so many ideas. But what were your thoughts?
Oh, Anna Greta, that was an amazing conversation, and I'm thinking of that comment that you made at the end, how privileged we are to be here at the ANU with such colleagues and such thinking. And as both Paul and Liz pointed out, this is really hard. The work that Treasury is trying to do, the work that's happening, you know, across the public sector, is really difficult. But I love the point that Liz made about the need for the intergenerational report to be both doable and to have vision. And I think what we are lacking is a boldness of vision in Australia at the moment. We're seeing the beginnings of that. And I think there really is a thirst for some bold vision. And that goes to our identity, to our values, to how we see ourselves and who we want to be. And I think we are seeing some thinking from government that's moving in that direction, but moving very tentatively. And so we really need more boldness. You know, this idea of well-being is potentially a mind changer. It potentially reshapes how we think about our society. But we've got ourselves stuck in the indicators and we've lost the potential for a really big vision. And just on the idea or the measuring what matters framework, the other comment that I keep making about that is that it's a child-free zone. It's only thinking about the well-being of adults. And so it's not, and it can't be intergenerational. We need to think much more broadly and much more deeply. In the next intergenerational report, we need that chapter on inequality. But I'd argue that we also need a chapter on poverty. Because while we have poverty in this wealthy country, we'll necessarily have entrenched inequality. So we need to give license to our political leaders to have vision, to be bold, and to talk and walk with them on that, rather than always falling back into the political game of bipartisanship.
I really love that idea of our role, particularly in academia, but also across our communities, of inspiring our politicians to be brave and to be bold. It really was an extraordinary conversation. I know I'm going to come back to this one regularly over the months that are ahead because of the capacity for Liz and Paul to really weave together the challenge of siloed thinking, the ways in which that stymies effective policy research and change, and to see the advantages of that whole of life or whole of system type approach. This balancing act between science, what we can actually measure, and the imagination that's required to fully appreciate the human life and the human experience and to actually give space, to give voice, to give narrative to what matters. Sharon, that wellbeing framework I know has been in our mind, and I'm actually well aware that on the pod we haven't discussed this yet with any of our local experts. I think there is a lot to unpack from the federal government's approach to wellbeing, and I really hope we have an opportunity to do that between now and the end of the year.
I think we might find a moment when we can do that.
Excellent.
And I think we might also have Liz and Paul back. There's much more to talk with them about.
Fantastic. Listeners, this podcast is produced by ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy, and we'll leave a link to the publications and sources that we've discussed on today's episode with the Crawford LinkedIn account. If you liked this episode, please don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're feeling generous, you can leave us a review. We really love to get feedback. And it is, of course, the best way for other people to find out about our podcast.
We love hearing from you, our audience, so please do reach out to us on Twitter at ANU Crawford or through our newish email address, policyforumpod@anu.edu.au. Our thanks to Hannah Scott for production and to Darcy Brumpton and to Alex Jackson for background research. That's all we have time for this week. So from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
And from me, Anna-Greta Hunter, we'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.